funeral prayers. Iranian and Hamas political figures, along with mourners, come together in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to take part in the ceremony. Politicians and citizens alike called for justice, assuring that the Israeli assassination would not go unavenged.
Another mistake of the Zionist regime is that they do not pay attention to the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. If the enemy attacks, they shall receive counterattacks. We have shown this through time.
Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh was killed in a strike on his residence in Tehran on Wednesday. The Israeli crime, along with the green light from the United States, escalated tensions in the West Asia region. In Haniyeh's funeral, people said the path of resistance will be followed stronger than ever, and that they continue to uphold the principles that the Hamas leader championed.
Today we say goodbye to our leader Ismail Haniyeh, the one whom the Zionist regime thought that by assassinating him it could divert our path, or weaken our will, or reduce our efforts. By committing this new crime, the Zionist regime has shown the whole world that it is the manifestation of evil in the region. The whole world now should work together to eradicate this cancer.
Iranians from across the country converge in the capital to take part in Ismail Haniyeh's funeral and a display of unity with the people in Gaza, an untrammeled support for the Palestinian cause.
We came today to support the people of Gaza and say that we are with you until the end. With the martyrdom of Ismail Haniyeh, the resistance will only become stronger. Hopefully, this genocide in Gaza will end soon.
I have come to show solidarity with the people of Gaza. God willing, they will be the victors. God willing, with resistance and patience, Israel will soon be destroyed.
The Iranian capital witnessed large crowds of mourners who came together to pay their support and bid farewell to martyr Ismail Haniyeh and pledge their support for the Palestinian cause. Reza Hashemi, Tehran.
And moving on, White House National Security Advisor John Kirby says that the recent warning by Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei regarding the revenge for the assassination of Hamas Political Bureau Chief Ismail Haniyeh must be taken seriously. In a televised interview, Kirby said Tehran has already proven that it is able and willing to carry out major attacks against Israel. He also noted that the U.S. will implement all necessary precautions to ensure the defense of itself and its allies in the region. On Wednesday, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei issued a stern warning to Israel, promising a harsh response for Haniyeh's assassination. He emphasized that Iran considers it a duty to avenge the blood of the Hamas leader who was martyred on Iranian soil. While Israel has assassinated the political bureau chief and a senior Hezbollah commander in a matter of hours amid the genocidal war on Palestinian people, regional resistance groups, which acted in coordination in recent months in the face of the Gaza genocide, have vowed retaliation. Israel's assassination and the possible response by the axis of resistance were the topics of our explainer.
When it comes to targeted assassinations, the Israeli regime leads the pack. But why has Israel resorted to this terroristic act, which is against international law? And why did Israel decide to carry out two targeted assassinations in a matter of 48 hours, knowing that it would face a retaliation which may include all or some of the resistance groups in West Asia? Well, it's worth first taking a look at the resistance groups and countries in the West Asia region. You're looking at the three major ones, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, of which they are hosting these resistance groups, like Lebanon hosting Hezbollah, Syria, home to the National Defense Forces, and then Yemen hosts the Ansarullah movements. In terms of Palestinian resistance groups, well, there are four major ones. Let's name them, as you're seeing here, Kataib Ezzedine Ghassam. Also, you have Hamas, which is the one that at this point very much covered in the news. Iraq is another country that is host to many resistance groups. There's 18 of them that are active, some of which you are seeing here, such as Hashd al-Shaabi, Islamic Resistance of Iraq, to name a couple. Now, a word on Iraq. Following the assassination of martyr Hajj Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis by the U.S., 18 new Iraqi resistance groups, as mentioned, emerged to fight the U.S. occupation of Iraq. These groups are all active, ready to act against the U.S. occupation forces. You're seeing some of these groups' logos in this particular snapshot. The groups have carried on an average of 250 attacks, as you see there, against U.S. troops and U.S. interests. Now, these countries and groups combined form what's called the Axis of Resistance. You're going to see the outline here. The boxes here show some of those groups that are part of this Axis of Resistance, all to have worked against not only the Israeli regime, but also against the U.S. presence on their soil, which has led to the instability in various countries. For example, U.S. in Syria, they're there illegally stealing its oil at the same time. Well, a quick review of the events over a 48-hour period, it points to the fact that there's a level of coordination that actually took place between the U.S. and the Israeli regime. From what we're seeing here, not only were there assassinations, for example, in Beirut and in the Islamic Republic, Beirut being there, the U.S. also carried out attacks in Iraq on a base belonging to Hashd al-Shaabi that you see over here, killing four members of the group there. There are reports that one U.S. Force was also killed. There was also an attack that happened inside of Syria by the Israeli regime. Let's not forget the patience that Iran has exercised since Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Through almost 10 months of this genocide, Iran and the resistance groups have struck a balance that put pressure on the Israel regime, with resistance groups sharply increasing attacks while avoiding an all-out war. Example of these attacks have come from, for example, Yemen, the Islamic resistance in Iraq, and more recently joint operations between the two against the Israeli regime, such as on the port of Haifa and even Tel Aviv itself. Now, in April, Iran executed its biggest attack on Israel, the first ever attack on the Israeli regime and the occupied land directly, the name Operation True Promise, which I'm sure you heard of. Hundreds of missiles and drones were launched in retaliation for an Israeli strike that happened on Iran's embassy compound that killed some Iranian military commanders in Damascus, Syria. Operation True Promise, well, it involved these missiles and drones and rockets. Let's not forget hypersonic ones also, which hit targets with pinpoint accuracy. Now, let's take a look at what we're going to maybe see. Not maybe, at this point, it's almost confirmed, if not 100% confirmed, that there is going to be retaliation coming from Iran. Iran's leader, based on an article by the New York Times, reportedly based on some sources that they didn't want to name, has attacked an order on Israel. This happened yesterday in terms of the news that the New York Times reported. It's unclear how forcefully Iran is going to respond. Perhaps it's going to be another combination attack of drones and missiles like Operation True Promise, or maybe on military targets close to Tel Aviv and Haifa so the regime can feel the wrath that it's going to have coming. Will Iran target civilian targets? Well, at this point, that's anybody's guess. The other option, if not a do-it-alone, would be a coordinated attack involving Iran and other resistance forces like from Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, in order to get maximum effect and damage. The reason this may be the go-to scenario is that the U.S. has also struck Hashd al-Shaabi. If the Axis of Resistance doesn't respond in some way, it would jeopardize the purpose of the alliance in some way. And this is what Iran has in its arsenal. It's good to take a look at that in terms of ballistic missiles, 3,000 to 5,000, including hypersonic ones. You're also looking at drones, 10 models of that. And then in terms of the army itself, could be as high as 700 to 800,000, of which you have about 500,000 of them on active duty. When you put all that together, along with the missile capabilities and the fighters of the resistance groups, an all-out military attack against the Israeli regime, well, for the regime and the U.S. is not going to be a walk in the park, and that's something they need to watch out for.
Turkey's internet regulator has blocked access to Instagram following accusations of censorship related to the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh. The regulator provided no reason for the ban. The move came 2 days after the communications director of the Turkish presidency criticized Instagram for what he called pure censorship. Fahrettin Altun slammed Instagram for blocking condolence posts on Haniyeh's martyrdom without citing any policy violations. Instagram's parent company, Meta, has faced widespread criticism in the past for censoring pro-Palestine content or posts related to pro-resistance figures, including Iran's assassinated general Qasem Soleimani. Critics say such behavior is part of a systematic censorship aimed at silencing pro-Palestine voices. Now, it is nearly 10 months into the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The regime continues to pound the Palestinian territory with more airstrikes and artillery fire. One of the latest attacks in the last is at least three people who were killed in the Israeli bombings of a residential building in central Gaza. Several people were also injured elsewhere in central Gaza. Regime warplanes struck the Deir al-Bala area, killing a number of Palestinians. Eight civilians were also killed after Israeli jets targeted a civilian vehicle near the Al-Maghazi refugee camp. In Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, a Palestinian woman was killed in an airstrike on a home. The regime artillery fire also targeted several areas across Gaza, leaving unknown numbers of Palestinians dead or injured. A total of nearly 39,500 Palestinians have been killed and over 91,000 injured since the regime's genocide started last October. And the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war has worsened the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Palestinians there are facing hunger and disease amid lack of food and medical supplies. Let's take a listen to some of the Gazans talking about the hardships that they face.
For how long? How much longer is this silence going to last? The silence of the Arabs, the silence of the Muslims, the silence of the world towards the suffering of the Palestinian people. What do you want? Do you want the people of Gaza to offer more than this? We have lost children, women. We gave our souls. We gave our homes. We gave our lands. What else do you want? We're steadfast. We're steadfast despite the hunger, despite the thirst, and you have seen how the people of Gaza live. That diseases are killing us on all sides. On top of the hunger, on top of the thirst, on top of the lack of shelter, it's summer, and you know what the heat of the summer is like.
300 days and the Israeli aggression continues against our country and people, despite the hunger, the deprivation, the shortages, the death and destruction. But we remain steadfast in the land of Isra and Al-Miraj.
Palestinians detained by Israeli forces in Gaza face torture and mistreatment while in custody. Now that is according to some of the prisoners who have recently been released from jail. Let's take a listen to the comments made by two of them who have endured inhumane conditions in Israeli jails.
They took me to the Kerem Shalom crossing. They put us in a jeep and covered our faces and drove us away. On the way, they were torturing, beating, hitting, and electrocuting us. We've never experienced such torture before. They put us in a building for 12 days. Every day, they took us one floor down while beating and torturing us all along. They forced us to sit down on our feet. We were blindfolded. We weren't allowed to move or talk. I was in detention for 46 days. They would ask me, "Where are the tunnels? Are you part of the resistance? Are you a Hamas member?" They would ask me about the resistance. We would tell them that we are affiliated neither with Hamas nor Fatah. But they wouldn't take that as an answer. Under torture, you had to speak. If you are weak and can't withstand torture, you have to tell them something. There are some people who said they were part of Hamas, although they were not, just because of torture.
I was arrested at Kamal Adwan Hospital and remained in detention for 8 months. I was imprisoned in Ofer and in Negev. Those were the worst days. I was sat on my knees for 51 days. I slept at midnight and was woken up at 4 in the morning. I was sat on my knees all the day. I wasn't allowed to move. We were subjected to all kinds of torture. I was tortured by electrocution. Once they dressed me in a Qassam Brigade's uniform and wanted to take me down in a tunnel. I refused. They tried to force me to go down in a tunnel. tunnel, and when I refused, they sat me on an electric chair and started torturing me. That was an offer.
Yemeni protesters have poured onto the streets of the northern city of Saada in yet another rally of support of war-ravaged Gaza. The demonstration was one of the biggest by the Yemenis in the past months. They have been holding rallies in Saada and the capital Sana'a on Fridays since the Gaza war broke out in early October. The Yemeni protesters denounced Israel and its main supporter, the U.S., for the genocide in Gaza. They also hailed the Yemeni army for its military operations targeting Israel-linked vessels in the high seas. Those operations have been ongoing since mid-November to force Israel to end its war on Gaza. Yemen says it will continue to back Palestinians until the war comes to an end. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Donald Trump's allies and Project 2025 proposed restrictions to the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to protect the American public from toxins like PFAS. According to experts, a second Donald Trump term could boost toxic forever chemicals. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A second Donald Trump presidency would represent a serious threat to dealing with toxic impact of PFAS forever chemicals, as well as other toxins, and could be a danger to the health of millions of Americans, according to experts and environmental campaigners. For example, over the past year, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, developed groundbreaking drinking water limits for highly toxic PFAS compounds and designated several of the forever chemicals as hazardous substances, a move that will force industry to clean up its pollution. The steps represent a major win for the water quality and taxpayers, but a new Trump administration would likely shred the rules. Statements from former Trump Environmental Protection Agency officials, the far-right Project 2025 plan, and the Trump-allied American Chemistry Council target these rules, but also suggests industry in a second administration aims are much deeper. They are proposing administration changes designed to cripple the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to protect the public health from chemicals like PFAS. Project 2025's assault on the Environmental Protection Agency is coordinated with the recent conservative wins in the judiciary that undermine the agency's ability to make rules, and the proposals' broad aims are to consolidate as much decision-making about toxic chemicals at the Environmental Protection Agency into the hands of a small group of Trump appointees instead of scientists. Project 2025 is being run by the right-wing Heritage Foundation as a blueprint for a Trump administration. Basically, the entire infrastructure of how the Environmental Protection Agency considers science and develops rules is very much under attack, according to Eric Olson, the legislative director with the National Resource Defense Council. Eric Olson added, the Trump administration learned some lessons and would be much more surgical and effective at affixation next time. According to Olson, PFAS are a class of about 15,000 compounds typically used to make products that resist water, stains, and heat. They're called forever chemicals because they do not naturally break down and accumulate and are linked to cancer, kidney disease, liver problems, immune disorders, birth defects, and other serious health problems. The Biden administration in 2021 rolled out the PFAS Strategic Roadmap, a sweeping government-wide plan designed to rein in pollution in water, air, food, soil, and across the economy. At the top of the industry's target list are the drinking water limits, which our American Chemistry Council and its allies have sued to attempt to block. A revolving door exists between the American Chemical Council, which is the fourth largest lobbying group in the United States, and the Trump administration. Though Project 2025 doesn't mention the limits explicitly, it calls for Trump to revise groundwater cleanup regulations and policies to reflect the challenges of omnipresent contaminants like PFAS. That conveys an industry talking point. PFAS contamination is everywhere, so regulatory agencies should not force industry to do too much. Project 2025 also calls for the elimination of the Environmental Protection Agency's system and office that assesses chemicals' toxicity and dangers. The office's findings are used in the agency's regulatory arm to set protective standards, and it is doing multiple reviews of PFAS. Industry has long sought to hobble the office because it makes it more difficult to set business-friendly rules, and the office is deep in the Environmental Protection Agency, insulated from political appointee pressure, an agency employee who requested anonymity has confirmed. They would rather not have part of the agency saying, oh, these chemicals are toxic, where they're trying to make the case that the chemicals are fine and we can all eat and drink them, according to the employee. The American Chemical Council and Project 2025 aim to narrow the definition of PFAS to exclude some from regulation, and language in the plan calls for the reclassification of some dangerous substances so they're no longer considered a threat. That trick has been used to claim dangerously polluted sites have been addressed when they have not, the Environmental Protection Agency employee said, or it could be used to thwart PFAS regulation. The Environmental Protection Agency is in the process of developing regulations for subclasses of PFAS. This is important because so many PFAS exist that it is impossible to regulate them one by one. No data exists for most PFAS, so scientists rely on chemical analogs that are similar in structure to fill in gaps and determine chemicals as dangers. Project 2025 effectively calls for the elimination of that mechanism. They want us to have less information to use, so we have to say, well, we have no information to go off of, so we cannot restrict it, the Environmental Protection Agency employee said, just because you don't have any information on a chemical does not mean that that chemical is safe. The plan also points towards making it impossible for the agency to ban dangerous chemicals. Former Trump administration officials have regularly derided concerns over PFAS as scare tactics, and Project 2025 claims regulation around toxic chemicals should be eliminated because they are based on fear as a result of mischaracterized or incomplete science. That's a rhetorical trick because science is never complete, according to the EPA official. More broadly, there is evidence to steal the EPA's rulemaking ability and concentrate power among political appointees. On day one, the Environmental Protection Agency will not conduct any ongoing or planned science activity for which there is not clear and current congressional authorization. Project 2025 states it would grant the White House control over decisions when science is being manipulated at the agencies to support separate political and institutional agendas, as industry has suggested in the case with PFAS. Meanwhile, the entire Office of Research and Development might be eliminated because there is no law that states that the Environmental Protection Agency has to do research, according to the EPA employee. That's part of this pattern of, if we don't like what the EPA is doing, then we will take it out of their hands, the employee emphasized. They want a small group of 20 people making the rules, and the rest of the agency can go to hell as far as they are concerned. The website of the Pinnacle Gazette has also covered the same story and tells us more. Experts have warned a second Donald Trump presidency may dismantle crucial PFAS regulations and threaten environmental safety. As the political landscape shifts in anticipation of a second potential Donald Trump presidency, experts are voicing serious concerns regarding the future of environmental health and safety regulations, especially concerning the notorious class of chemicals known as PFAS, commonly referred to as forever chemicals. These substances, notorious for their resilience in the environment and the human body, have been linked to a host of serious health issues, including cancers, liver damage, and immune system problems. With Donald Trump positioning himself as a favored candidate for a Republican nomination, the implications of his policies on public health and regulatory practices have sparked alarm bells among health professionals and environmental advocates alike. In recent years, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, has made strides to combat the pollution of PFAS, establishing new drinking water limits and designating various compounds within this class as hazardous substances. Such actions have been considered landmark victories for the environmental safety, effectively mandating industries to address and rectify incidents of contamination. However, many fear that if Donald Trump were to return to office, he would swiftly dismantle these advancements, potentially endangering the health of millions of Americans. Statements from former Trump administration officials on the far-right wing Project 2025 plans suggest a clear agenda to undermine the Environmental Protection Agency's regulatory power and restrict its capability to safeguard public health from hazardous chemicals. The American Chemicals Council, the ACC, is the fourth largest lobbying group in the United States and has been particularly vocal against the recent rules designed to limit PFAS in drinking water, echoing concerns from industry insiders that the measures interfere with business operations.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. U.S. Congress just rolled out the red carpet for today's public enemy number one, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, wanted for war crimes in the Gaza Strip by the International Criminal Court, received dozens of standing ovations by U.S. lawmakers as he stood and laid out a case to try and justify his regime's campaign of genocide in Gaza. Yet major media outlets all throughout the world, including CNN, Reuters, ABC and NBC News, the BBC, the Associated Press, and the AFP have all outlined and debunked most of Benjamin Netanyahu's claims and denials throughout his speech. So why all the lies? And if you're standing up for what is right, then why is everything coming out of your mouth wrong? This is the subject of this episode of your Spotlight. Joining us is Yves Engler, author and political activist, joining us out of Montreal. And John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us out of Fredericton, Canada. And gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to this Spotlight program. I guess, Yves, we'll start with you, if we may. Let's open the conversation on why you, as the U.S. Congress, would invite this man after he's been accused of war crimes and he's had a war crimes warrant issued for him. And, you understand he's already inflicted irreparable damage to not only his own regime's reputation, but also to that of yours. Why would you want to stand there and have him speak in front of your country?
Well, I think there's two parts to the answer to this. One is that Republicans invited him as a way to act like Joe Biden had not given full throttle support, because at one moment they paused 2,000-pound bombs that they were giving to Israel, and Netanyahu made a big kerfuffle about that. And the Republicans, for their partisan reasons, are trying to frame Biden as not being completely behind Israel. So there's a sort of narrow kind of partisan element, but then the broader element, of course, is that the U.S. has enabled Israel's criminal activities, Netanyahu's criminal activities. And so they're essentially just applauding the politician that they have been arming to kill Palestinians.
And John, welcome to the program. I'd like to put that same opening question to you, if I may. I mean, the Israeli regime has been enough of a stain for U.S. politics for years, but why add this genocide and bring Netanyahu at such a delicate time to before lawmakers in America?
Well, I think that we've got to remember that the horse has to come before the cart here. It's not a decision being made in Washington to invite Netanyahu. It's certainly not just a decision by the Republican Party. We've got to remember the seminal work on this subject called The Israel Lobby by Dr. John Mearsheimer, where Dr. Mearsheimer points out that 60% of the donations to the Democratic Party come from Jewish Americans, from the Israel lobby, and 40% of the financing for the Republican Party come from Jewish Americans, meaning that Jewish Americans are the main financiers of both parties. And when they get an order from Tel Aviv or from Jerusalem to tell the American government, which is financed by Jewish donors, both parties, and they order the Americans to bring the Prime Minister of Israel to speak, then he gets to come and speak. Because the cart here is America, the military-industrial complex of America, is being driven and being pulled by the Israeli lobby that controls the U.S. Congress. So it's not surprise to see them embarrassing themselves in front of the U.S. public. And it's such a disaster that even Nancy Pelosi, who's, of course, been on the Israeli lobby payroll for years, even she denounced Netanyahu's speech as the worst speech ever given to the U.S. Congress by a foreign leader, because she realizes that the people of America and even many Jewish Americans are outraged by the obvious and open genocide by Israel against the Palestinian people, and they simply can't hide it anymore. So the gig is up, the game is open to everyone, and America now doesn't know what to do because they've just been following orders from the Israel lobby for decades. And we're talking about next year being 77 years of the Israel lobby pulling the strings on the U.S. government.
Thank you there, John. And gentlemen, you know, all the major outlets also debunked and fact-checked so many things that Netanyahu said. 90% of it didn't check out. He said Israel has barely killed any civilians in Rafah, fact-checked against UN tallies and a lie. Israel is not blocking the entry of aid into Gaza. It gets in, but Hamas steals it, fact-checked by UN organizations, and a blatant lie. Hamas refused to cooperate for a ceasefire. Another lie. You guys see where this is going. Eves, why this level of dishonesty?
Well, when you're committing a Holocaust in Gaza, it's difficult to just come out and say, hey, we're killing tens and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands ultimately here of Palestinians, mostly children, women, civilians. So it's you don't come out and say that for obvious reasons. That would most people in the world think that's wrong. So they just lie and they lie. I mean, this is you know, the supporters of Israel. If you take a quick look in their media in Canada or online social media, I mean, it's an endless stream of lies. They are the victims, according to them, not the people being that they are killing, that Israel's killing. It's a kind of mainstreaming of these lies, in front of the world all at once, in front of the U.S. Congress. But this is just the norm of what Israel's been doing. Every time they blow up a hospital, they attack a hospital, that's they come up with some story to either to deny they were involved or that they, you know, were just trying to get Hamas or whatever. It's been 10 months of lies. I mean, it's been a century of Zionist lies, but in the last 10 months, we've just had this ramped up. Now, you point out that there was fact checking that actually took place to, you know, restrain a little bit the most egregious fairy tales that Netanyahu was telling everyone. But for the most part, they lie because they get away with it, because what else do you do when you're trying to defend the indefensible? And the media, for the most part, doesn't push back. And obviously the politicians that were giving standing ovation after standing ovation weren't pushing back.
And John, what's the deal with that? Why over 70 standing ovations? I mean, most of these politicians know very well what part of his speech were lies and which weren't. He would tell a lie. He would tell a lie, John. They would know he's lying, and they would stand up and clap for him. How is him not telling bold-faced lies to these politicians' faces not patronizing and condescending from their perspective?
Look, I know this is going to be hard to believe, but I worked in Washington as a lobbyist, and I went to members of the Congress and to the upper house, to the Senate, and asked them to act on certain matters. And basically, I was given a menu of how much money we have to pay to get certain actions. Standing ovation was on the list. Mm. So if you see a member of Congress standing in a standing ovation dealing with a presentation by Israel, that's a bonus. That person standing up gets a bonus from the Israel lobby. I want to read you a short quote. I hope we have the time. Here it is. If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. The lie can be maintained for only such a time as the state shields the people from the political economic truth. Who said that? Joseph Goebbels. I'm quoting from the Jewish Virtual Library. Netanyahu has followed the instructions of Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels to the letter. And if that doesn't tell the world how terrible the situation is for the Palestinian people, and that the Prime Minister of Israel is applying the rules of communication developed by Joseph Goebbels, then nothing else can get the truth across. That's where we've come. The Prime Minister of Israel is following Nazi propaganda rules.
Hmm. Interesting, John. And Yves, Netanyahu said protests outside, and there were scores of protesters right outside. He said they've been financed by Iran. Now, that's another thing that U.S. intelligence debunked, saying the protesters and their grievances are completely legitimate and been ongoing for months now, especially at major U.S. universities in multiple cities, and they're people from all walks of life, including young college students, and they are no way connected to Iran. But my question to you, why does Netanyahu need people to believe that? Why does he need people to believe that opposition to this Gaza genocide is somehow corrupted or bought or compromised?
Yeah, he wants to portray all Palestinian grievances as coming from Iran, right? That Palestinians resisting century of dispossession is something that Iran has put them up to, or Iran was responsible for Hamas's attacks on October 7th and all this kind of stuff. So that's one. They've been pushing that a lot, and it's for good reason. They don't want to. Israel wants to take away from the obvious legitimate grievances of Palestinians over the past 10 months, but over the past century. The other part, of course, is kind of similar, is that they don't want to, and they did this a lot. You saw a lot of this with the student encampments, where they tried to frame that rather than just being individuals who were morally outraged by what they were seeing, that in fact it was something sponsored, and they tried to hold this whole business about the tents at the student encampments on universities were like all apparently purchased by the same source, that they tried to do this whole thing, and they showed that there were a lot of these tents that the same colors in the one encampment, which was explained, of course, by the fact that if you go and buy 10 of the cheapest tents at Walmart, they all happen to be the same color and you know, whatever. but it was all kind of ridiculous, but they got all over. I mean, you had whole stories in Canadian outlets, and you still do, saying here in Montreal, the one was that Iran was paying for the different protests in different parts of the city. They were dividing up the city. I mean, like anyone, I go to these demonstrations, you know, most weekends, and it had nothing to do with the actual organizing process, where, first of all, it was one demonstration. It wasn't divided up in the city. It really made no sense. But this was being reported on by major media outlets and continues to be reported on. And so it's a way of course, just, undercutting the moral legitimacy. Obviously, within our media here, Iran has been, you know, demonized endlessly. So it's this big boogeyman and all bad things. So it plays off of that. This is a long history of that. They same kind of dynamics during Vietnam War protests. They claim it was, you know, the Soviets funding it, or they were the useful idiots of whatever. So there's a long history of trying to, sort of demonize popular, let's be really clear too, volunteer-based social movements by these tactics. And one other further thing about all this is that, you know, online on social media and Twitter, whatever, it's endless stream of this stuff from these Israel lobby people who are actually all paid, right? Like the there's a probably 10 in Canada, there's probably like 10 people that have jobs with the Canadians for Justice of Peace in the Middle East, or Independent Jewish Voices, or other groups that are involved in pro-Palestinian activism. Maybe it's 20 people who have like paid positions across the whole country. But on the other hand, on the Israel lobby side, you have like hundreds of people who are paid by CIJA, by B'nai B'rith, by Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center. These groups all have, you know, $10 million budgets and these big budgets. And they're making the accusation that the paid activists are, in fact, those who have been, you know, the students who have been sleeping in, you know, encampments for 2 months and you know, didn't receive a penny. Maybe they received a free muffin or, you know, a free water bottle. That's like the extent of the the assistance they receive. But it's a common tactic of those in power and the dominant media really go along with. And of course, Netanyahu, again, this is all part of, you know, him trying to just say there's no moral legitimacy to these protests.
But John, wouldn't that give him more credibility as a speaker out there in front of these U.S. lawmakers if he gives some legitimacy to the grievances of 40,000 people killed, over 70% women and children in Gaza?
Once again, the bigger the lie, the more likely people are to accept it. Israel, and specifically Netanyahu, has been lying about the situation from start to finish. And the idea, it's almost insane to suggest it. Iran has no method to get money to demonstrators across America. And Iran is totally sanctioned. There is no way to transfer money legally or illegally to people in America. The people who are demonstrating are Americans who have simply fed up. And the demonstrations against the crimes of the State of Israel, against the Palestinian people, predate the Islamic Republic of Iran. Even during the time of the Shah, Americans across the country were protesting against Israel, and the Shah certainly wasn't doing the paying. So this is a lie based on nothing other than the hatred and the demonization that they've been working on against Iran for generations. This is the way they operate. The truth will out. People like myself who have never received a cent from Iran, I've never been to Iran, have the reason to argue against Israel, and the reason is the pursuit and the sharing of the truth. And that cannot be bought.
Eves, thank you, John. And Eves, Yemen's answer to the leader, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, he said celebrating Netanyahu, as U.S. lawmakers did yesterday evening, is a celebration of crime, tyranny, and genocide, and underlines America's partnership and complicity in the Gaza onslaught. So these U.S. lawmakers, are they really buying, Eves, what Netanyahu is peddling? I mean, what has he or his occupation forces done or achieved or accomplished in Gaza that warrants celebration or praise?
Is that question to me?
You want to let Eve answer it first, and I'll come right back to you.
Okay.
I don't think that these politicians necessarily believe what Netanyahu is saying. That's one thing. I think they are just their disposition is to be pro-Israel, and their disposition to be pro-Israel is based upon the funding they receive, based upon there's a current of Christian Zionism, there's the U.S. empire, the arms industry that likes, you know, providing weapons to the killing machine. There's lots of factors that go into why they're so pro-Israel. I agree. I think this is very damaging for, ultimately quite damaging for the U.S. empire, because the world sees the horrors that Israel's inflicting in Gaza. And the world understands to varying degrees that the U.S. is supporting Israel. I don't think they necessarily understand how much of Israel's weaponry comes from the U.S. and how important the U.S. is in assisting, with intelligence and all kinds of ways in which they directly assist Israel's crimes. But what this does in having all these politicians just so openly and crassly celebrate Netanyahu, I think it's a very bad strategic move from the standpoint of the U.S. empire, from the standpoint of U.S. Moral authority in the world. And U.S. moral authority is obviously, they don't have that much of it, but they still do have a certain soft kind of power element that does matter to an extent. And so when the whole world sees just such a crass display at the heart of U.S. Politics in terms of just openly endorsing the slaughter of, babies, the introduction of polio to Gaza, just the horror after horror that we're seeing play out, I think that is quite damaging. And I do think that ultimately you can't really, I think you can explain, like if you look at U.S. foreign policy all around the world, it is militaristic, it is imperialistic, It is profit-oriented. But I think you can ultimately, this is not sensible from the U.S. empire strategy standpoint. So you can really only explain that level of support for Netanyahu from the standpoint of domestic politics, and specifically the fact that the power of the Israel lobby. I think there are other factors that explain, but I think that the power of the organized Jewish community, pro-Israel Jewish community, because of many, many tens and hundreds of thousands of American Jews who are critical, but the establishment organizations and their, you know, the funding relationship and the like. Because as you pointed out, the leader of Yemen, you know, this is the world to see, and it's a lot of people, not just the Arab world, but all around the world, Africa and Latin America, they see this level of endorsement of such criminality. It's just not good for the U.S. Reputation.
And let me put that same question to you, John. Do you agree with Eves? Because, I mean, he's possibly the most despised man on the planet right now. Here's a room full of politicians basically celebrating the guy. I mean, do you see them as what, a bunch of gullible goofs or culpable criminals, John?
But it is absolutely culpable criminals who are accessories to the crime, both before the crime, because they gave the go-ahead before it happened, during the crime, which is continuing now, and after the crime, they will continue to protect Netanyahu so that he doesn't get extradited to the ICC. The Americans don't even recognize the ICC, the International Criminal Court. And the reason why they don't recognize the court is because they would be in the dock first. America has invaded. America has bombed. America has killed tens of millions of people. And Israel is simply doing the same thing that America does all around the world in the occupied territories. So these are two criminals in cahoots, both committing the same crimes, both guilty of genocide, and both using their lying mainstream media and a blockout of information and sanctions to keep what we are saying to you, both myself and my fellow commentator today, to keep what we are saying from getting to the ears of normal people everywhere who would be even more opposed if they could hear what was coming, the real facts of what's happening in the region. You will not see video, pictures, or interviews in the mainstream media anywhere in the Western world because the Israel lobby has blocked it through the governments that they control through bribery.
Interesting. And Eves, are you surprised at all that this guy stood there and spoke of everything and anything that he could, but he never really touched on two things that the whole world is concerned about at this point, including the region of West Asia, which is what? A ceasefire and return of captives. Even his own people, that may not support him, but Israelis in occupied Palestine that may be even in opposition to, they just want him to talk about a ceasefire and get the captives home. The two things he barely even mentioned in that speech.
Yeah, well, they've been making this whole propaganda story about how the whole operation is about, you know, getting the Israelis who are, you know, captured in Gaza home. I mean, when we know that days into it, Hamas offered to release a whole bunch of people who they didn't actually necessarily want, because a lot of Israelis were brought in not necessarily by the Hamas forces. He's been making this whole case that all this, you know, while they've killed many more of their people in these bombing campaigns than they have retrieved. It's a central part of the propaganda. Another part, I mean, one of the ones that drives me kind of find it's just so incredible. Canadian politicians, probably U.S. same with U.S. is like, they talk endlessly about hostages, but never talk about how there's about 100 times more Palestinians that are hostages by Israel. And you never hear any mention of that. It's just totally remarkable.
Eves, I don't want to cut you off. We only have about 40 seconds to a minute left. I want to get this last question to John before we go. John, do U.S. lawmakers really not see that wherever Benjamin Netanyahu goes, all he does is add to chaos, division, and polarization, whether it's Tel Aviv or between Muslim leaders in the region that occupy Palestine, is that even every time he visits America, all he does is push people apart. He's the ultimate anti-peace.
Look, Netanyahu would have been removed from power by his own Israeli people had this incident not taken place. Netanyahu was on the way out. Netanyahu is now basically a man without a mandate, a man who can do whatever he wants, has piles of money behind him, and has nuclear weapons in his back pocket. This is Dr. Strangelove on steroids, and it is a threat not just to the region, but the entire world. And it's got to be stopped.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us and putting the time to be on the program. Yves Engler, they're joining us from Montreal. And John Bossin is joining us out of Fredericton, Canada. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about the Master of the Martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned.